everyone. This is the HTC Inside Pulse Wrestling Pulsecast. I am your host, Matt Herrick. I was not on the show last week, but I sure hope you were able to listen to the interview that I had exclusively with the man behind the curtain of WWE Creative Humor on Twitter. If you did it, it's available on iTunes as well as Blog Talk Radio and as well as our site, htcwrestling.com. This week, we are back again full force with our host and crew of Hidden Canvas, Justin Cam. And we are going top five. We're going to throw in a little quick reviews of WWE's Payback pay-per-view as well as Raw on Monday. Very eventful Raw on Monday. And then we're jumping right into the top five most misused wrestlers in wrestling history. First off, though, let's see how the rest of the guys are doing. Justin, what's going on?
Oh, nothing much here. Just obviously getting ready to talk some wrestling and give a quick review of what I think was a very eventful past handful of days in the WWE.
It was eventful. I don't know if it was very eventful, but we'll get into that. On the other line, we have Cam. Cam, how you doing?
I'm good. I think it was actually pretty eventful. I don't know how quick Raw is going to be because I have a lot to talk about Raw. I think it's been the best Raw in years.
I agree. It was one of the best Raws, but we are not talking that much about Raw. I'm honestly, it's one of our things that right now we are running into a backlog as far as size for shows that we're doing. So I know originally we always told you and always told everybody that we go as long and short as possible. Right now we are going to stick as close to 60 minutes as humanly possible. And I have a feeling that we're going to get into an intense debate with some of the choices that we all have for this top five topic. Before that though, quickly, just for the pay-per-view, obviously, some events happened on the pay-per-view, but it was nothing too out of the ordinary. It was a decent show. I give it a thumbs in the middle. There were some things that were great, some not so much. And I'd have to say the best. I haven't been able to go back and watch it again. I just trying to go back from Sunday and think about the best match, and honestly, the only matches are coming to my mind are the ones from Raw. So I would have to say probably the best match was Del Rio Ziggler. I like the way that they played off the injury angle. The finish was a little bit of a letdown, obviously, but I understand where they were going with the double turn, and probably might be the one thing that's remembered from this pay-per-view. Let me throw it over to you guys first, just for the pay-per-view. Just give me your overall reaction, thumbs up, thumbs down, and what was the highlight of the night for you? Let's go, Justin.
I would give it thumbs slightly raised a little bit. For me, going into the pay-per-view, I had low expectations just with the way the whole card was built. I mean, the main event match especially, I think as far as the whole pay-per-view, that Cena-Ryback match was obviously, to me, probably the most disappointing match of the night. I thought everything else was good to very good. Like you said, Matt, the story with Ziggler, Del Rio, and the double turn going on, it was very well built. It was very well done throughout the entire match, just building up. And some of those kicks, I think toward the end, at least for me, I was just cringing watching Del Rio land some of those kicks, getting worried that something that Ziggler might get re-injured again because they were so very well delivered. But I thought the whole double turn was done very well. The CM Punk Chris Jericho match I thought was very very well. Obviously, you know, those two are two of the best workers the WWE has right now. So, you know, they can put on a good match like they did, and I thought it was very well done. And I thought the undercard wasn't bad as well. I thought the Intercontinental title match was a good opener. I thought the Shields matches were good as well. And even the Divas match, I thought, played in very well to the whole storyline with Caitlyn trying to humiliate AJ and then ending up losing the match at the end. So, like I said, I give it thumbs slightly raised. It wasn't a great pay-per-view, but it was good and much better than what I was expecting.
Yeah, that was generally how I thought of it, too. I completely lost my train of thought. So let's throw it over to Cam so maybe I can get back on track.
I think you guys are kind of being a little too judgmental. It's one of those filler pay-per-views. I thought it was actually pretty good. I mean, one of those pay-per-views that it was almost worth the money. I would have paid $40. I wish you could do a system where you would pay on how much you enjoyed it. I would have paid about $40, maybe $45. I thought it was really good. I thought they're actually, the Divas division is a highlight to me. They're really bringing to do. They know that TNA has a solid Divas division, so they really need to do something, and I think they're really building drama, which, you know, wrestling's supposed to do. You're supposed to build suspicion, so I think they're doing a good job with that. Other than the no storyline between Chris Jericho and CM Punk, I thought it was a great match. You know, made the night for me. I just back and forth. CM Punk has no ring rust, I think. And you know, overall, I thought it was a great pay-per-view. Even Ryback, John Cena, I mean, it is what it is between those two, but I thought it was at least an entertaining match, what they did with, you know, as limited movement they have between the two of them.
Yeah, you liked it a lot more than I think Justin and I liked it. For me, it felt like a throwaway. Like you said, there was no story whatsoever for Jericho and Punk. He just kind of showed up and went about his business. And maybe any other wrestler you would expect that from, but CM Punk not being able to actually build a story before the match or after the match or barely during the match, the announcers actually did a pretty good job of trying to point out the fact that he might have ring rust and that he's getting blown up and he's not really on his A game. The match itself obviously wasn't really showing that because he really did look like he has been wrestling this entire time, just a little less injured, which is nice to see. But besides that, I mean, that and the Ziggler one, that's what I was going to say before was because Dolph Ziggler hadn't really done anything physical before his match on Sunday, and the fact that they went with that whole ruthless attack of Ziggler's head and his concussion, I wasn't sure going into the show if Ziggler was technically cleared. I know they said it numerous times, but then he would be booked for matches or he'd be on a house show and they would take him off or they'd replace him. So I think they had the idea of that story going into the pay-per-view, and if they let it slip beforehand on TV or on house shows that he was okay and everything was fine and he'd be cleared to wrestle, it wouldn't have as much of an impact as it did. And like I said on my 10 thoughts on Monday, as much as I don't think you could really top the double turn of Austin and Steve and Bret Hart. Del Rio's promo on Monday was probably his best work as a heel, and I don't like him very much at all as a competitor. I thought he had a chance as a babyface when he first started because he is a big guy who could pull off luchador moves, but the promo he cut was good. It was good. It was what it needed to be. I'm a little concerned on what they do with Ziggler simply because we've never seen Dolph Ziggler as a babyface. And yes, his in-ring work is very, very crowd-friendly, but can he cut a promo that doesn't grate on your nerves and where he can actually get a crowd behind him by speaking rather than throwing himself around a wrestling ring? With that being said, just moving forward quickly into Monday Night Raw, like I said, it was a very eventful Monday Night Raw, but we do want to get to our top fives. Raw for me was, obviously it was better than the pay-per-view. I think as a full-blown show, it's kind of scary that it's becoming the trend that the Raw after a pay-per-view is a better show than the pay-per-views are. It makes you think that they're pre-planning for their supposed WWE Network idea where they're only going to put pay-per-views on their network. So why show anything good on the pay-per-view when people are only going to be watching Raw? It was good. There was a lot of twists and turns and literally and figuratively, and it kept you interested. It was the first show I think I've sat through where I wasn't looking at the clock seeing how much longer I have to wait until the show was over. A lot went down, a lot happened, a lot of new things really clicked into gear for the summer. This really did feel like the kickoff into SummerSlam and probably will last us until after SummerSlam, the pay-per-view after SummerSlam. So for the next 4 months or so, I think we have a good idea of how WWE is trending and what's coming up, especially with the Money in the Bank in between now and the SummerSlam event. Cam, I know you said you really want to talk about Raw, so in your shortest possible explanation of what you want to elaborate on for the next hour, give us your assessment of Raw.
Like I said, I thought it was one of the best Raws in a long time, despite there being a three-man band signing. I mean, you can just quickly forget about that. The WWE actually built intrigue to viewers to make, you know, part-time fans want to come back. If they happen to watch Raw on Monday, they, you know, are probably going to watch Raw next week just because of what happened. Other than the U.S. title, I mean, every title has a vision now. It has a picture, you know, what we're going to see, even singles matches. I mean, the return of Mark Henry I thought was absolutely sensational. John Cena even did a great job acting that, like co-writing on this promo. I mean, as of right now, it's the promo of the year to me. I mean, John Cena could have screwed this completely up, but he was perfect. I mean, he did a great job of, you know, letting Mark Henry set up for his, you know, one last run, possibly for a WWE title, but I don't think so. Brock Lesnar's return, I mean, other than the obvious, okay, Brock Lesnar doesn't travel with the WWE, so he was going to be used. I mean, that's an easy joke to make, but his next feud is set. I think it's going to be the only feud he has that makes sense since The Rock in 2002, and I just can't wait until CM Punk goes one-on-one with Paul Heyman on the microphone, because you all know that's going to be good.
Yeah, I agree with you for the most part. The thing that about the Brock Lesnar CM Punk thing, and it was something that I mentioned in my 10 Thoughts column on, I think I posted on Tuesday. I don't even know what day of the week it is today. I posted that it was interesting that they stuck with the idea of bringing Brock Lesnar in for SummerSlam, even though the original idea was to have him face The Rock. I think it showed a lot of faith, not only in Brock versus Punk, but the fact that they believe Punk can bring in a hot crowd, which is usually going to be in LA, no matter what. But he's also going to be able to bring in pay-per-view buys against Brock Lesnar compared to The Rock versus Brock Lesnar. I don't think they would have burned a Lesnar date and all the stuff that has to lead up to it unless they were certain that it was going to be a box office success. And, I mean, obviously they're building up other matches, too, that will probably co-headline the event. But when you think back on it and you knew that the timeline was Lesnar versus Rock for SummerSlam, and now it's Lesnar versus Punk, I think it showed a lot of faith in him as a performer, stuff that we already agree with, but we really didn't get the chance to see it on television as much as we wanted to. I'm glad they're going that direction. It's something new. It's something different. And like I said, this is the first time that Brock Lesnar and CM Punk were seen on screen together in history. And that doesn't happen anymore. WWE and wrestling in general aren't making new legends. I think the argument can be made for CM Punk will go down as a Hall of Famer, but overall, they are not building people that can have that return moment that Brock Lesnar has, that Chris Jericho has, that, I mean, even Triple H has, and The Rock, that has been on TV a lot more than we thought he would be. But they're not really building these people up, so when they do retire and come or step away for a long time and come back, that people would go nuts for them. So this might be the last kind of generational era where we're able to have two guys who are from a similar style of generation but have never crossed paths before in WWE. And I think it will bring in a good rating. You know it's going to make for interesting television, simply, like you said, Cam, because of the Paul Heyman, CM Punk interactions. You know they're not going to let Brock Lesnar talk, especially when Punk's on the other side of the microphone. But yeah, it's going to be an intriguing couple of months. Justin, what were your thoughts on Raw?
I agree with Cam. Very good Raw. 99% sure I gave it my highest rating of the year. I gave it an 8.5. like I said, like you said already, the CM Punk Brock Lesnar feud, like you said, man, it's the one feud that, like, it's a generational one. They don't know. Two guys that have never crossed paths before, even though they're both Paul Heyman guys. They've never been on the screen before at the same time. So I think made that moment even better. You know, they're basically managed by the same guy, but they've never been seen together. So that made that work. I'm looking forward to that, obviously, like, presumably at SummerSlam. I don't think they're going to do that at Money in the Bank. Then you got the Mark Henry, John Cena feud, which is very well done. Great acting job by Henry. Very, very good. I can't overstate that enough. And I know people are saying, well, oh, we can see a John Cena Mark Henry match. But I honestly think, especially pre, or I should say from 2011 till now, I think Mark Henry has been very underrated as a worker in the ring. I'm not saying he's a world beater, he's a great wrestler, a great ring technician, but he can hold his own in there with guys. I mean, you've seen him put on good matches with CM Punk, and I don't even think his matches with the Big Show when he had that feud with him were that bad. So I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes. Obviously, to see them go at Money in the Bank. And even the McMahon Triple H stuff, it was kept to a minimum this week, and I think they're kind of teasing a big match for them at SummerSlam, where you saw Vince McMahon gave his somewhat backing of the Shield, saying that he liked seeing them around running roughshod. And I think you might see at SummerSlam building up to something where kind of control of the company is on the line, with the Shield representing Vince McMahon and Triple H presumably having his own team wrestling for himself. And then, you know, we've heard the rumors that The Undertaker might come back for SummerSlam. And I could see maybe Triple H, The Undertaker, and then obviously maybe just throw in Kane there for the whole Brothers of Destruction thing, adding another big match to SummerSlam where you see The Undertaker, who doesn't normally wrestle outside of WrestleMania the last couple of years, outside of obviously after this past WrestleMania, come back. We saw Dean Ambrose kind of tease a little bit when he talked about taking out The Undertaker a few months ago, so there's that too. But yeah, very good Raw. It's something that I'm looking forward to seeing what they do this summer. I know they don't really have their big summer angles where we had the CM Punk pipe bomb and Nexus, and last year with CM Punk turning heel. But it seems like this year, instead of focusing on one main event, they're branching out to about three or four different kind of big storylines, and we still have, you know, we don't know who's going to win Money in the Bank, who the favorites are there, and there's obviously, you know, the Daniel Bryan being over so much, we don't know where his push is going. Is he still going to get a WWE title push? He kind of briefly mentioned saying he wanted to win the title on Raw, so there's always, they could do a number one contenders match maybe at the pay-per-view with him and Randy Orton and Kane to see where that goes, but there's a lot of good storylines there that can branch out from this coming Raw, and I'm just very interested to see where everything goes from here.
What I found interesting about, you brought up the McMahon and Triple H idea, what I found interesting, and it was something that I wasn't sure was going to happen when, was it 2-3 weeks ago when they were in Hartford when Vince and Stephanie came out to the ring, and they played up the whole thing of Stephanie is kind of the go-between in between Vince and Triple H, and kind of trying to play neutral ground there and get everybody to go along. They kind of stepped away from that this past Monday and showed that she wants a big say in this as well. So it's not just a power play in between Vince McMahon and Triple H, which I think would get rather boring after a while, simply because it's been done so much before. Now that they're throwing in the wrinkle of Stephanie, who's married, obviously, to Hunter and is the daughter of Vince, her wanting to have control of the company and kind of showing up Vicky and then showing up the Divas later on in the night, it's a three-person power struggle instead of the typical two. It adds a little different dimension to the feud, and something that I don't know how far they can go with it, simply because, like Justin said, it would be a good idea to maybe build teams and have them face each other. But it's like, do you do that with the three of them, or are they going to keep her like kind of working behind the backs of the other two, so they don't really know that she's trying to take over the company as well? It added a new wrinkle for me, and in the beginning, I wasn't too sold on it. It's always fun having the McMahons back on television. Obviously, they were probably the most intriguing family ever in wrestling. But adding Stephanie into that, and the fact that, I mean, she is just a phenomenal on-screen character, adding her to the mix, I think, just adds a little bit more meat to the storyline than I expected to begin with. Cam, do you have anything to add about that angle going through?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like you said, it's been done before, but I think this time there's just something a little bit different. Just like, I mean, you know, last week they went with the comedy relief and it was very light. And again this week it was very light. You know, Stephanie, who runs Creative Telling, you know, who, I can't remember who they were talking to, Curtis Axel or whoever they were talking to, that she can have them taken off TV, which I thought was funny because, you know, she runs Creative. But, I mean, right now it's very subtle, and I think they're going to wait and wait. I don't even think SummerSlam. I mean, maybe they do the six-man match, like you said, Justin, but I think it's just going to build from there until, like, WrestleMania 30. But I think I like it. I mean, like I said, they've done this before, but it's PG era, and it's very light. It's very subtle, so I think they're doing a great job, and especially for the new fans who've never really seen Stephanie and Hunter and Vince can fight over control of the WWE. They've never seen this before, so, you know, it's something new to them, and they're excited, and they want to see what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think they did a good job just in this past week. I know they've been building Daniel Bryan for a while, and when I made the comments on my article on Tuesday, I didn't realize that the injury stoppage and everything, that was a legit shoot, and he had hurt himself. It wasn't a stinger like they reported, but he does have a shoulder injury, but he did compete on SmackDown. So it's not as bad as they thought they were. But besides his character being built up over the last couple weeks, we really didn't get a good sense of where WWE was going. At one point, it seemed like they were going with Curtis Axel versus Triple H. They totally steered away from that and have Axel going against Miz now with the title, and Triple H just primarily focusing on the McMahon drama. Raw really did set up a lot of things that weren't really in play, and it kind of illuminated it all a little bit. I think it helps that, obviously, it helps that CM Punk is back and uninjured and ready to go. The fact they brought back Brock Lesnar is another main eventer that they're able to throw in there that's not named John Cena. I'm not as high on Mark Henry and versus John Cena for match quality. I think Henry typically needs somebody, I was going to say somebody to work off of, but he typically needs a ring general. And if you go back in history and you look at matches where John Cena has been the ring general in the match or has been the veteran in the match, they don't come off very well. And both of these guys work a strong style. It's going to have to be a very heavy storytelling type of a match and not a in-ring spectacle. But it's something to keep Cena occupied until what we expect will be the Daniel Bryan push and him facing Bryan for the title. So hopefully this is just a placeholder and we'll only be treated to one match of theirs and not a prolonged feud. But I agree with you. His promo on Monday was spot on. It was probably the best work of his career. I'm just not too keen on seeing the in-ring work between John Cena and Mark Henry. I think it's going to drag a little bit too much for my taste. Moving on, though, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's got the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, so most of the matches are going to be, like, high-paced. You know, you're going to have, like, another Intercontinental title match, and CM Punk might be working or might be some sort of confrontation, so you got to have that, like, big-man-type match to kind of set them, you know, kill the crowd, especially at the end.
Yeah, but you don't want to have that with the WWE title on the line. That's the issue. If it was just, like, because they did last year, it's at SummerSlam, as Mark Henry, Sheamus, and it was a big man match, and I mean, it worked well, and they both did a great job with it, but it wasn't a featured match, it wasn't at the top of the card, it was on there to establish both of these characters. One was a brand new babyface, the other was trying to reestablish Mark Henry as a monster. By putting him in a program with John Cena, no matter what, they're going to be near the top of the card, and I just think you're gonna kill an audience instead of, like you said, most of the matches on the show are going to be high paced, and they are going to be a giant spectacle of guys flying around and just giving it their all, and then you're going to have the plotting a slow working match between Cena and Henry. And if that goes on last, obviously they're probably, I can't say obviously and probably, but they're probably going to go with a John Cena victory to establish him again as being the top dog in WWE. And that will send some of the kids home happy. But when you're sitting there and you're watching it and you're just kind of like, okay, this entire card was great. And then you're waiting and your last match is John Cena versus Mark Henry. Like, if it wasn't a pay-per-view, I would turn off the television. Like, that's just not something that I want to stick around for in the main event. Justin?
Yeah, no, I agree, especially because you have, like I said, as long as I'm looking forward to the match, I can see your point where you don't want to have a slow, dull-moving match like that, especially with, you know, with Money in the Bank review being in front of in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is usually a hostile crowd. Obviously, they have their home background from their old ECW days, as obviously a long time ago. But Philadelphia is kind of like maybe a Chicago-like crowd where they won't get as on them as much as you Chicago crowd did, but I can see them getting on that match, especially, like I said, with not their no CM Punk in the main event. Two guys, John Cena, obviously not very well liked by the internet community, and Mark Henry, while he delivered a strong promo, there are still people who don't really aren't fans of him. So I could see that happening, but I could also see, especially with it taking place at Money in the Bank, with the crowd just being so worn out from both ladder matches, and presumably maybe a Dolph Ziggler match and a Daniel Bryan singles match, where they just, to the point where they just sit there on their hands and just not even care about the match and don't even worry about doing a chant. So that's the one thing I think with Money in the Bank, that it potentially hides that from there. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I like I said, I think it's going to be it's going to be rough as far as match placement. I'm hoping that they realize that and they don't put them on last. But again, this is John Cena and this is the WWE title. So I that might be a lot of false hope that we're, that at least I'm trying to get around. But yeah, so that's the state of WWE now. But now we want to look in the past. We want to look going back, not just WWE, but across the board pro wrestling history. For me, this top five list was a pain in the ass. Thank you, Justin, for suggesting it. it was one of those things where I'm like, okay, I have to look through the entire history of pro wrestling. And there's no way to look through the history of pro wrestling unless you narrow it down to certain territories. So, yeah, this was a pain in the ass. But I think I'm pretty satisfied with my top five. Again, this will be the top five most misused wrestlers in history. My parameters, just to throw it out there and give you a little insight of what my list is going to look like, I kind of looked at it as not stuff that the wrestler might have done to themselves, but things that management dropped the ball on. Like, I was looking at some things and some websites and different wrestlers, and a lot of people had, I don't know if it's on your list, we don't know who has what on this one, but a lot of people had Jake Roberts on there, and personally, that wasn't management's fault, that wasn't any booker's fault, that wasn't any territory's fault or any federation, that was his demons taking over and him not being able to compete at a higher standard and not being able, or not allowing promoters to place enough trust into him to have him go any higher on the card. So I wouldn't put him in the misused category simply because he did what he did to himself. He had all the talent in the world, but he's the one that screwed himself over. It wasn't management not having faith in him. It wasn't them burying him for other reasons. It was the fact that he did it to himself. It was stuff he could have stopped, but he was an addict. Obviously, you can't just stop by free will, but he hurt himself. It wasn't somebody else. Was that what you guys went by, or was it totally different for you? About Justin, you're the one who brought this up.
Yeah, my criteria is basically, I don't know, kind of similar, but it was stars. My list has some, like, oh, actually, probably a lot of well-known guys on it, but that may have been booked well somewhere, and then when they went somewhere else, they weren't booked the right way they should have, or they weren't given a push like they were in their other promotion, when you know they had in them, obviously by watching them do what they did in promotion A, then they went to promotion B and didn't have it there. So you know they could be a guy, top guy in the company, but they weren't pushed as so. And even there were some guys on there that was screwed up just by they started off good in the promotion, but then management screwed something up, and then they basically just fell off the wayside. So that is what my list looks like.
Okay, Cam?
So, Justin, your list is basically the entire TNA roster. Oh, zinger. No, I guess, well, Jake Roberts is on my list, just to throw that out there. I guess I was going by just hits and misses by creative and bookers problems. I mean, I know Jake Roberts had problems with drugs and alcohol, but I guess we'll get into that. But, yeah, mine was just based on, like, hits and misses from creative and bookers.
Okay, so we probably all will have different people on our list. Justin, the way you explained it, I had a lot of guys that I put in more so my honorable mentions that kind of fit that idea, simply because it was going back and forth. It's like, well, he was used really well in one organization, so he wasn't completely mismanaged. It was just that one group didn't know how to utilize his talents as well as another one did. So that's why I have them on my honorable mentions instead of having them on my top five. But we'll see how it goes. It's going to be an interesting one. I'm not kicking it off this week. It's not my list. Let's throw it to you, Justin. You're the one who brought it up.
Okay. My number five, like I said, just right off that criteria, guy that was used well in ECW, and then he made a very good debut, I thought, in WCW, and that is a guy who I think is actually a little bit underrated as a worker, and that's Mike Awesome. I thought he was booked very well by Paul Heyman in ECW. He was made to look like this monster of a wrestler. He won the ECW world title there, and then he made his again, I didn't follow the internet at the time, so I don't know if it was a surprise to them, but it was a surprise debut on WCW where he took out Kevin Nash when he was in the ring. And you kind of assumed from there that he was going to get a giant push. And I know it was in the middle of the New Blood feud that he debuted against the Millionaires Club. So obviously it wasn't the dying days of WCW, so you don't know how much longer it would have went. But he started off kind of strong, and then they just completely, I don't know, you know, at the time when WCW at that point already jumped the shark. And they changed him into the fat lady thriller gimmick, and then they changed him into the That 70s Show, Mike Awesome. And it was just so bad and so corny when you saw how good he could have been, how good he was in ECW. Again, he was booked by Paul Heyman, and there was also obviously the whole outside being able to use weapons, stuff like that. But I thought he worked well enough in the ring where he could have gotten a main event push, especially when at that time WCW really didn't have too much going for it in his dying days. I thought Awesome could have been a fresh face on top of that WCW into his dying days. And obviously, I think even when he went to WWE, could have been used a little better, especially because he's a guy that has the look that obviously that we all know Vince McMahon likes, the tall, big guys that he likes to push for some reason. But I think Mike Awesome, like I said, Mike Awesome, WCW after is number five on my list.
It is interesting. The way you started that out, I thought you were going a totally different direction with who your five was. But honestly, and this could be just me, when he got to WCW, like you said, it was the dying days of WCW. I had pretty much stopped watching around the time of the Millionaires Club, New Breed, just simply because it was terrible. But I do remember Mike Awesome in ECW, and I remember, yeah, he was a big guy with a lot of physical attributes that could be utilized and could potentially make him a huge star. I think he ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time. He signed with WCW when WCW was on its very, very last legs. And it was kind of just throwing stuff to the wall and see what sticks with him. Never really got out of the gates as far as his character goes. I didn't have him on my list anywhere simply because I didn't think he was as talented as maybe you remember. That's just my opinion, obviously. I'm sure there's going to be people on my list that you don't think are nearly as talented as they should be. But for me, Mike Awesome had good matches with, I can't think of the Japanese wrestler's name.
Masato Tanaka.
Tanaka, thank you. I thought that was the only time that Awesome really showed me that how good he was in the ring. It was the only time that I felt that he was living up to potential, and it was the only time that I really saw money in him. So I wouldn't really consider him a misused, and in my opinion, simply because I don't think the talent was there, and obviously WCW had no idea what they were doing. So it was just kind of it's kind of a mix of the both of them, and it was just ended up being awful for both sides. But yeah, that's me. Cam?
I had Mike Awesome in my honorable mentions, and I get for the same reason as Justin. I just think at the end of the WCW days, it was a very weird place to be, and I think that him signing there was kind of a bad idea. I think maybe he probably should have worked the indie scene or something and try to get a WWE contract. But yeah, just for the same reason, Justin's just total hit and miss with gimmicks, man, especially for Mike Awesome.
Yeah, and like I said, he went through far too many gimmicks in a short amount of time, and there was something there, and I don't think it was just management holding him back. I think there's a lot of crap going around, and he just happened to be caught right in the middle of it, and it was bad timing, I think, for everybody's part. Let me go on to my top five my number five, because it kind of plays into, like I said, how you were describing who your number five was, is exactly how I would describe my number five in Taz. This is a guy who was legitimately looked at as a badass that you don't want to mess with in ECW. He was their top guy. He was the guy that would go in there and choke you out or knock you out. Basically, just pick people up and drop them on their heads. That's who this guy was. And in ECW, he was this tough badass. Gets to WWE. Huge, huge debut at Survivor Series, defeating Kurt Angle with a chokeout, with his submissions, his Taz mission, or whatever he was calling it at that point. Everything had Taz in front of it. But it was at the Garden, got a massive pop, everything was looking great, and he went, I think, all of 3 months before WWE bought out ECW and WCW, and he was lumped into the Alliance mismanagement of the world. And after that, he even had a short feud with Steve Austin, but after that is disappeared, and then hurt his neck and decided, you know what, it's better for me just to sit out, and hey, maybe I could fill in commentary for this new ECW brand. And that's how he was able to get over and what he's doing right now. But when he first debuted with WWE, it looked like this guy who had the reputation of being a badass and being a legitimate tough man comes in, beats Kurt Angle, looks like he might be going on a winning streak, and that nobody's going to be able to stop this guy just because of how good he is, how tough he is. And I think the highlight of his WWF or WWE career was a tag team championship with Spike Dudley. And to me, that just screams mismanagement when you go from a guy who is a world champion in one organization to a kind of underdog tag team champion with another guy who you wouldn't even look twice to on the street. I mean, I've met Taz before, and I'm a legit 5'6", 5'7". Taz was at least 3 or 4 inches shorter than I am. So he was a very small guy going into the land of the giants of the WWE, and it just seemed like he never really had a shot, and he could have. I think he really, really could have made a difference in that company during that era, and it just didn't happen. Cam?
I actually have Taz in my list. We were talking about this on email, and I said I had a bunch of guys going on my list because I was, like I said, going on based on the idea of just creative, not really having anything good for the guys. And, yeah, Tavis is on my list. I think the exact same thing. I thought he could have been the leader of, you know, some sort of, you know, hardcore evolution, or not even a hardcore. I don't know. He just could have been one of the guys that still could be wrestling to this day if he didn't really hurt his neck. But the WWE, like, you know, maybe he just got caught in the crossfires of Vince McMahon just not really thinking that any of these guys were worth the shit. They were just, you know, buying a company and just, you know, just taking over a territory. And, yeah, Taz, I mean, I know I have another ECW guy further down on my list. So I think that the whole ECW brand, in my opinion, was just completely mismanaged when Vince brought it out.
Yeah, what was funny was that Taz actually jumped ship before the buyout, and he went back to going back to Justin's number five when Mike Awesome was leaving ECW. WWE let Taz go back to ECW and win the ECW championship away from Awesome, who was going to WCW at the time. So they really did seem like they had big plans for him, and it just disappeared. And it could have been Vince, as the old saying goes, he found a new toy to play with, and Taz wasn't on the radar anymore. And unfortunately, he fizzled out much more quickly than I think his talent deserved. And there could have been a lot more done with him. And now we're treated to listening to him commentate very badly in TNA right now. But Justin, what do you have on Taz?
Just pretty much, I agree with everything that you guys said. Like, his debut in Madison Square Garden in New York was just a great moment. He ended Kurt Angle's undefeated streak, and you thought he was going to get, like you said, a big push. He was a guy that, you know, obviously, like you said, he wasn't a big, tall guy, but he was somebody that could work in the ring. We saw him do what he could do in ECW, and then I think the next summer he was feuding with Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross, and it was just something that it's tough to see that big debut happen, and then, you know, he's like months later, he's just in feuding with Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross, and I think he was in a 15-man hardcore title match at WrestleMania, and he was just somebody that you saw his height potential in ECW, and then when he goes to one of the big boys, like you said, Vince saw a toy, he liked it, and he got bored with it a month later. So yeah, definitely wasted potential in the WWE.
Cool. Yeah, let's go to Cam. You're number five.
My list actually almost goes chronologically from newest to oldest, which is kind of weird. I didn't really try to do that on purpose. But my number five is kind of an outside-the-box guy. It's Tyson Kidd. I think, even though he's been out injured, he has been working superstars in NXT for countless years. I think if there was still a cruiserweight division, I wrote a column about this, that he could be one of the top two or three guys leading that entire cruiserweight division. He has the persona of that, you know, likable babyface, smiley babyface. He works in the ring. I mean, the highlight of his WWE career is losing in Money in the Bank. I mean, he had that one slip spot that he had that, you know, had everyone pop, and that's like the highlight of his career so far. I think that he has just been completely misused. He is one of those Hart Foundation type guys that just, you know, WWE's just completely dropping the ball on. And when he comes back healthy, I'm assuming he's going to go back to NXT or work superstars. And when he's ready, I mean, matches with him or with Sami Zayn or El Generico, if you prefer, Dean Ambrose, and possibly a heel coming back, a heel turn in Kofi Kingston would make for great TV.
Yeah, I have a little bit of an issue just with Tyson Kidd. Simply, I think he's the type of guy and the type of wrestler who was born and trained to be in a tag team. And unfortunately, WWE doesn't care about tag teams. I thought him and Justin Gabriel's team had a lot of potential and could have done a lot of good in a rejuvenated tag team division. But because of his injury and other factors that happened, it never panned out. And yeah, that is something that is kind of disappointing. I think he's a little too young to be considered misused yet, because it's not like, I mean, he's out injured. He's coming back at some point. We're all hoping that he comes back and is actually put into something good, something interesting. I actually made a comment on when I covered NXT last week's show that when Sami Zayn comes up to the WWE, whatever show they put him on, there's not really a brand split or whatever they do. But whatever they do decide to do with him, I'd like to see him into a tag team first. Because as a singles competitor, while he is standing out great in NXT, I think he would get lost in the shuffle very quickly on the main roster. Because he is a very, no pun intended, generic babyface. And he's flawless in the ring. He's got great mic skills. His personality is spot on. I've seen numerous times. He plays the underdog perfectly. And I want to see him in a tag team with a veteran. Like somebody that people recognize and people can say, oh, okay, I know him. Who's this new guy with him? Introduce him into the crowd, introduce him to the WWE universe, and show that this guy can go. And have him be able to display his persona a little bit here and there. Tyson Kidd could be a great, great support system for that. Putting those two together and having them either battle the Shield or battle whoever the hell the tag team champions will be at that time, I think they could be a great underdog tag team. And it goes back to my number five where I was talking about Spike Dudley and Taz. They were the underdog tag team, and yet they won the tag team titles and beat the Dudley boys and were beating top tag teams. Sometimes you need that. And Tyson Kidd and Sami Zayn are two great workers. Put them together. Put them in the ring with some sort of story. Even if it's Tyson Kidd's coming in and he's like, hey, I want to win tag team gold. I was the tag team champion. I was on a WrestleMania. I want to get back to that level. So I found this guy. I've worked with him a lot over the years, and we trained together. He helped me get back from my injury or whatever storyline they want to go with, and bring up this guy and have him put him in the ring. As soon as you put them in the ring and the way they work, I can absolutely see them turning out some great matches with whoever they're paired with. But yeah, Tyson Kidd, I fully agree that I don't think he's been used to his potential yet. I'm still kind of in the wait and see mode for him just because he is so young, and he is the last of, they always count, the last graduate of the Hart Dungeon. Even though that really doesn't hold the same amount of legacy and history to it as it did before. He is a name that people recognize. When he comes out, people know who he is. They might not remember a specific match or a specific story or anything like that, but he is somebody that people recognize. I think there's still a lot that can be done with him. And luckily enough, he is still young enough that they can do a lot with him. Justin?
Like you said, he's still a young guy. There's still potential with him. I think Tyson Kidd is one of those guys where he's in the wrong generation. I think if he was around 15 years ago in the height of the Monday Night Wars, where you had WCW highlighting the Cruiserweight division, and when WWE started to have somewhat of a light heavyweight division, I think he would have been gold there. He would have been getting the standout matches on TV like he should be getting. But like I said, I think now the WWE doesn't like to do that too much, even though there's the talk, obviously, all the time of the Cruiserweight division and if it's going to happen or not. I guess you can be a guy in the mid-card fighting Dean Ambrose for a U.S. title or fighting Curtis Axel for the Intercontinental title when he comes back. But, yeah, I can see how, especially not having any kind of time on Raw or SmackDown to have good matches, I can see how Tyson Kidd, could make a list.
Yeah, like I said, I think it was a solid choice. I just think he's more of a wait and see, and that's just how your list is progressing. For me, it was more of guys who either aren't in the business anymore or are more towards the twilight of their careers, where it's either their time is up, they don't have any shot anymore, and it's just a what if, like they could have been so great and they weren't. But like I said, I think Tyson Kidd still has that shot, and hopefully we'll be able to see that once he comes back from injury. Let me jump down to my number four, since we had Justin lead us off with number five. My number four honestly is very topical, which I didn't realize this until how topical it was until I saw the news story break today and posted on Inside Pulse. And it's kind of out of left field. in a different direction than probably we're all thinking for this list. But my number four is Matt Stryker. Simply commentary, Matt Stryker. Yeah, he's a workable person in the ring, but commentary wise, Matt Stryker to me was always our generation's Jim Ross. He was the type of guy who could, when you had him on the microphone, he was calling matches, he was calling moves, but he was also tying it in with the storyline as well as with the history of wrestling. I mean, this guy knows what he's talking about. Obviously, he's an intelligent person. He knows what's going on with the product. He knows the company. He knows what he does, his research. He just never was given that shot because it's long been discussed that Vince McMahon always hated Jim Ross's announcing style. And you can tell Matt Stryker is a student of Jim Ross. And unfortunately, we saw today that his contract was not renewed by WWE, so he is gone. He wasn't doing very much anyway, but he is now legitimately gone. I am begging TNA to pick him up, simply because I think get the uninspired Taz off of commentary or get Mike Tenay off of commentary, but that announced team desperately needs help. Matt Stryker is the type of guy who could really come in, and him being the first night on the show would know every single storyline, the back history, where the guy trained, who he trained for, where he wrestled before this, who he reminds him of in the 1970s and early territory days. I mean, this guy can pull random facts and matches out of thin air. And I just think that because of where he was working and because of who he had to listen to and how he had to adjust his announcing style, I think Matt Stryker was a much needed person in the WWE, and they completely dropped the ball on him in every way possible. I think he could have been the new generation's Jim Ross. How fondly we would look back on all of JR's matches. This guy, if given the proper leeway in how to prepare for a show and how to announce a show, he really, really could have stood out as being a great commentator. Justin?
I never really thought about Matt Stryker on the list. I didn't even think about it. I've always been so set on him as an announcer. I thought he's had his moments where he's shown he can be good, and it's also the time where I kind of got sick of him at the Royal Rumble 2 years ago when I forget if it was Booker T came out and he just started screaming, "I'm marking out, bro, I'm marking out, bro." So I think he's had his fits and misses. I can see where, like you said, he comes from the Jim Ross school of training where he knows everything that's going on. He knows, obviously, he wrestled in the ring, so he knows the right move, the right names for certain moves here or there. So, I guess I can see where he was somebody that could have been better utilized by the WWE, but it's somebody that I would have never thought putting on my list.
Okay, how about you, Cam?
Yeah, I guess the same thing. I never really thought about it. I thought the way he was used, like, towards the end was completely horrible, and I think it made him look horrible. I think I agree with you. If he would do something for TNA's team, I think he would, you know, bring that wrestling element into it and let, you know, Taz just deal with the Ace and Eights or whatever, you know, they do on a daily basis. I think, you know, just I never really thought about using him as like a wrestler in the category. But, yeah, that's a good one, Ben.
Okay, let's go to your number four.
My number four is Shelton Benjamin. I thought...
I knew that was going to show up on someone's. I knew it. Okay, go ahead.
I thought, like, his debut and his work in Team Angle was great. I thought, like, that cocky, heelish attitude he had, you know, worked well for him. I thought in the ring he really could back it up. But then when they made him a babyface and they bleached his hair and then they turned him into a heel and he's basically the same character. I mean, he wore jewelry and was... You know, I'm not exactly sure in like that R-Truth JTG category kind of where they really didn't know what to do with him. I thought it was really bad, and I thought what he's doing in ROH now is really proving why they should have kept him around. I thought he was a great talker, especially for someone that was always stuck in the mid card, other than his Money in the Bank matches at WrestleMania.
For me, the highlight of Shelton Benjamin's career was when they brought in his mom. I thought that was fantastic. I mean, I love her as an actress to begin with. I thought it was pretty cool that they actually went to Hollywood to hire an actual actress to play a manager. And I mean, I'm just thinking back now, because it was around the time I was working there, and I'm just thinking back now to Shelton Benjamin's Bummel, and just listening to her on the outside of the ring screaming for him and everything else. I thought that was pure entertainment. Before I get into mine about him, let's throw it over to you, Justin.
Like Shelton Benjamin is one of those guys where he had that one, I think it was, I thought he was drafted to Raw, and he had his match with Triple H, and he upset Triple H, and you thought, this guy's going to have plans for the future. You knew at the time it was an upset win, and he was still kind of young, and you thought maybe they'd build him up further down the line, maybe into a main event spot, and then he just kind of was stuck in a mid-card position for life, you know, Intercontinental titles. He was, you said, Camp, very good with the tag team with Team Angle and Charlie Haas. He just missed out on making my list. Like you said, Matt, I knew somebody was going to have him on there. But he was definitely, obviously, a talented guy in the ring. I mean, he put on that Gold Rush match with Shawn Michaels on that episode of Raw. He could hold his own up here. He just had good spot monkey, I guess you want to call it, ladder matches where he's diving off ladders, jumping around. So he's definitely a guy that should have been better used during his time in WWE, and then you just saw him, like you said, they brought in his mama, and he was pretty much dead after that. You knew nothing else was going to happen with him after that. He just turned into pretty much a joke of a character.
Yeah, Shelton for me was the reason why I didn't put him on my list, and it's one, I knew somebody was going to grab him. And like I said a couple shows ago, like I'm trying to stay away from the typical and try to throw in a little bit different different guys, maybe not even guys that like some of your list, and I'm sure on your other lists I would put them in my top five, but because I'm trying to think outside of the box, it makes it a little bit more difficult, and that's my own fault. The reason why I didn't want to put Shelton Benjamin, and he's not even in my honorable mentions, honestly, was because, like you said, he did get that upset win over Triple H, and then they started giving him a microphone and try to put him into different angles, and it didn't work. They tried to bring him up to the main event, and it just didn't work. He wasn't well-spoken at that time. I know he's gotten better since then, obviously. But when he was primed to be a top guy in WWE, he didn't have all the tools that you needed to be a top guy. So it was as if they gave him a shot, and it didn't pay off as well as they wanted it to. Yeah, they could have given him a little bit more, but it was also his fault as well in the fact that he wasn't able to capitalize on anything that was given to him. I mean, he was constantly either a U.S. or Intercontinental Champion, but you never saw the belt elevated when he was the champion. He was always the guy that they put the belt on to wrestle other guys, to build up a story, put on a good match, and he would carry the gold around. I mean, there was really nothing to his character or to any storyline that he had. I mean, I don't remember any storyline of him having when he was one of the champions. He just held the belt, and his whole gimmick was just what he worked in the ring and being a mid-card champion. So, he didn't get as much opportunity as he probably should have, considering the type of athlete he is and how incredible he is in the ring. But there also was a lot more holding him back on his end, and I'm glad to see that he's improved on that, but it might be a little too late for him now. Cam, do you have anything just to add on to our comments?
Yeah, I was just going to say he's basically the new Kofi Kingston. Kofi Kingston's the new Shelton Benjamin, I should say.
Yeah, and I completely see that. It's the guy they put in the ring to make other people look good. I mean, it's what Dolph Ziggler was doing for so long. Kofi has had a little bit wider range in the fact that they were giving him feuds, and he was a babyface, whereas Shelton was a heel for most of his WWE career. But yeah, it's that mid-card guy you always could get a good match out of, but is really truly only defined by the fact that he has a belt. And I think the fact that he never elevated any of the championships he had really says something about what his limit was as a performer. Justin, let's go over to your number four.
Okay, my number four, again, promotion specific, and I know you said Cam, he's on your list, and Matt, you brought him up right away, but it's Jake Roberts in WCW. At the time, WCW, Ric Flair was gone, he was in WWF, they were kind of lacking for a big-time star over there, and then Jake Roberts left after WrestleMania 8, and he signed his contract with WCW. Obviously, you know the backstage story with him signing a big money contract, and then Bill Watts, who he already had heat with from his time in Mid-South coming in, and basically Jake Roberts went from making close to $3 million. So I think, if I remember correctly, he was like in the $200,000 to $300,000 range. And then he came in, he had a very good debut with Sting. He attacked Sting, and they had his match of Halloween Havoc. It was the biggest grossing pay-per-view at the time WCW had. And then Roberts was gone, I believe, within like a month or two. And I think it was just a big drop of the ball for WCW. They had this big star from the WWE who was never a main event guy there. Obviously, like you said, Matt, he had his own demons. That was part of the problem. But I think at the time when WCW got him, without having Ric Flair around in the promotion, they could have used him so much better. He could have been, I think, a WCW world champion there. He could have held their top title, but everything just went by the wayside because of obviously the backstage heat that was there between Roberts and Bill Watts. You know, it's just something where you would have wished somebody else would have stepped in and just obviously, you know, we know the reputation that Bill Watts has from wrestling. He's very hard-nosed, sticks to his guns. He doesn't care what anybody else thinks about doing, but it's just something where you would have wished somebody, you would have seen somebody else step in and say, hey, we need him. We just had the highest grossing pay-per-view of all time here for WCW. We need him around, and I just think Roberts could have been used so much better in WCW, and unfortunately, our only lasting memory of him being there would be the Coal Miner's Glove match, him trying to get the snake to bite his face, and some really weird and cheesy promos building up to that match of Halloween Havoc.
Yeah, I think that we weren't the only ones that were victimized by the Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal match. I think Jake was the other, I think Sting's the only one that came out with any sort of, I wouldn't say leverage out of that match. I think he was the only one that was safe after that match. I said it before in our intro, Jake Roberts, for me, I like that you specified it down to his WCW time, because that really was when he left WWF at the time, and he was the first real big star to jump ship over to WCW. And this and nobody else jumped ship for another 5 to 10 years after that. It was just, this was a big star from the WWF, comes right into a feud with your franchise player of Sting, and he was still in shape. He was still the Jake Roberts that we know and that just like is mind-blowing to us. His promos, his psychology, his in-ring work, everything about Jake Roberts was spot on when he was clean. And yeah, WCW, anything from that time frame, you can label as misused. That was an awful, awful, awful period for WCW. It got even got worse for a while after that, but that was an awful time for WCW. Jake really had a bad stick, I don't know what the phrase I'm going for there. It was bad timing. He was a guy who, if he had jumped ship maybe 3 years before or maybe 5 years later, had stayed clean during that time, he might have been able to make more of an impact. But because of who Jake Roberts is, and because of the era of WCW that he arrived in, I don't think that he even had a shot. I think that was just they brought him in because it was Jake Roberts. He needed some place to work. He had been fired from WWE, and they snagged him up, threw him right into the main event, and obviously backstage politics, his own demons, everything just took over and he was done with. But that was a rough one because it's like I said at the very beginning, and now he's on both of your lists, and I already blew that off at the very beginning of the show. But Jake Roberts, to me, I think screwed himself more than anybody else screwed him. This one time frame that you label down, Justin, with the WCW time frame, there was a lot of other things that really screwed him during this time. So I could justify that being put on the list, but I think overall in his career, I think he did more harm to himself than anybody else did. Cam?
Yeah, Jake Snake's on my list. He's number two. It's funny that you said the WCW thing because I wrote down Jake Snake Roberts post-WCW, right, 1992 WWE run. I thought, clean or not clean, coming back from WCW, I thought that was the time. I mean, now as you look back, there was only one world title in the WWE, so the Intercontinental title was number two. But he was just one of those guys that I thought at that time was probably the most charismatic the most charismatic guy they had. I thought he was one of the best in the ring, obviously the best on the mic at the time. And I thought when he came back from WCW was the time to really capitalize, especially as you said, he just did the match with Sting and all this stuff. And I think, in my opinion, he might have messed up. And I'm not really too intel with the backstory of him coming back to WWE and him and Vince. But I thought he should have been used a little bit better. And just a little side note, I think Bill Watts is the worst promoter in the wrestling history.
And yet he's in the Hall of Fame. But, Jake Roberts, like I said, he, in any list or any sort of analyst of his career in anything he's done, it's kind of a sad story because he was a guy who had everything going for him. He had the perfect wrestling mind. He knew what he was doing. He knew how to draw in a crowd. He knew how to create a story. And the drug problems, the drinking, everything, he couldn't get away from it. And it's a really sad story. And it's something I'm happy with. I mean, when I did the interview with him a couple months ago, he sounded great. He sounded like the old Jake Roberts that we all grew up watching. And I'm hoping that this isn't the last we've ever seen of him and he is able to come back. I'm not saying come back in the ring. I'm saying if he can even contribute to the business and, he's getting his life together, I would love to see him as a part of any organization, just being able to lend his wrestling mind to it. I never considered Jake Roberts world championship material. And that could just be because of the era he was in. If he was a little bit later when it was the Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart era, I could see him being the top heel and the top villain. But because he was during the Macho Man, Hulk Hogan era, I could see him as being that upper mid-card guy that got whoever was next in line for the world championship, he got them ready for that belt. That's how I saw his role being played. That's how they did it with Ultimate Warrior, and they did it with somebody else too. So Undertaker, that's how they really got these guys established, was through Jake. I think that was going to be the height of his career. I don't really consider him somebody who should have won a world title. Compared to somebody like Roddy Piper, who he always said he never needed a title to get over, but he was the type of guy who should have been a world champion. But Jake Roberts, I just think there's just way too much going on there. And it's rough for me to put him on a misused category when there's so many other factors that played into his career. But, Cam, that was your number two. Give us your number three.
My number three is Raven. I think he – we mentioned Taz and we mentioned Mike Possum. In my opinion, I think he was the guy coming from ECW that, brought something that the other guys really didn't bring from ECW. He was a talker. In my opinion, he's in my top 10 of best talkers in wrestling history. I thought –
he played a great role. I mean, he never was a babyface, but, you know, he created the suspense and he sold the matches and he sold the feuds he was about to go through. I mean, he was, in my opinion at least, above average in the ring, but I think he was just stuck with the stigma of an ECW guy, and that's all he could offer, and I think that's the only thing that WWE saw in him was just an ECW guy.
Raven, for me, I mean, and you can relate it back to my analyst of Taz. This is a guy who was over in ECW, obviously. He is the top guy. He knew what he was doing. He knew his character. It's probably because Scott Levy is very much like Raven. But I think he was misused. When he got to WWE the second time, the first time around was as Scotty Polo. But when he got to WWE the second time around, he was lumped in with the Alliance. And anybody that was lumped in with the Alliance kind of got just got pushed aside, especially since it failed so quickly. Raven, though, I thought got a pretty good shake when he was in WCW. I think if you look back on it, his feud with Diamond Dallas Page, eventually his feud with Diamond Dallas Page, and he had a couple matches with Goldberg and matches with Perry Saturn. I feel like he was a very strong mid-card guy. He never moved past that, but this was also the era of WCW of the NWO. There were so many guys that were on the roster that could have been a world champion that were just lumped into the NWO or WCW feud. So for him to be able to stand out among that and have his own flock and have stellar matches that didn't revolve around the main storyline helped him stand out. But there was no way that he was going to be shot up into main event level or even a world title opportunity when WCW versus NWO was the top draw of WCW. There's no way somebody that wasn't involved in one of those two groups was going to win the title, unless your name was Sting, but he was considered WCW. Justin?
Yeah, I agree. Raven was pretty much, like you said, one of those guys that was the wrong place at the wrong time. He was great in ECW. His promos, his constant feud with Tommy Dreamer the whole time he was there. They were all very good, very, like you said, demonic, almost like, I want to say, I wouldn't put it up there with them, but it's maybe like a Jake Roberts light kind of thing he had going on. But then, like you said, he's just in the wrong place at the wrong time in WCW with the whole NWO thing going on. And then, like you said, in the WWE, Vince McMahon doesn't really like bringing in people too much and pushing them, especially if he's not a guy that created them, and he wasn't going to be a top guy in the ECW Alliance thing. So just kind of, like I said, wrong place, wrong time.
Justin, what was your number three?
My number three is one of those things where this guy started off kind of well, and he was getting some great heel heat at the time, and then he had one stupid incident because of the WWE booking team screwed it up completely, and that is Muhammad Hassan. I think he's a guy, I think his character was one of those ones where it walked a tight rope almost the entire time he had it going, but he was getting some great heat with it the whole time. I mean, he was involved in a segment at WrestleMania with Hulk Hogan, and that kind of put him over big, and he was kind of doing the whole, like, stereotypical thing where obviously it was still a little bit after 9/11, and he was, you know, doing the whole being prejudiced against by the American people, and then they just had that stupid incident on SmackDown, and I know they try to say because of the London bombings and it was taped and they didn't have enough time to do it, but that was just a stupid thing to do just overall, especially, like I said, with the tight lines the character itself was walking at the time, and then they had that whole stupid black mass terrorist incident on SmackDown, and then I know he was rumored to get a world title match at SummerSlam against Batista, and I think he was actually rumored to win. I think that would have been – I know he wasn't the greatest worker in the ring. He held his own. I just think he would have been gotten so much heel heat at the time. He would have been such a major heel in the WWE that I think it would have been just great for the company to have something like that, and then they just screwed it up with the one incident on SmackDown, and he was pretty much – I was actually – at the Great American Bash pay-per-view where The Undertaker powerbombed him to the stage, and that was the last we saw of him. So I just think it was something where the WWE had gold in front of them. They could have had this major guy getting heat in every single building that he went into, and then they just screwed it up with their own doing because of that incident that happened on SmackDown.
If Muhammad Hassan is your number three, do you have, like, Kevin Thorne at number two? Like, Jesus, random names of, like, 2006, 2007 WWE. Just, bad timing. I didn't even consider, even when I'm thinking back and I'm like, I was looking at the different lists of people I was looking through, and I don't even remember his name showing up on some things. I saw Daivari show up a bunch of times, so I don't even remember Hassan's name showing up on things. For me, I didn't see enough of him as far as in ring goes. He was stuck with the Arab character, and during a time when it wasn't like when Hulk Hogan was fighting Sergeant Slaughter. I mean, this guy came in. I mean, he looked like what the generic American person wanted to hate. He had that look. They made him look that way with the headdress and the writing on his hair, big writing on his tights and everything else. And I don't know. I didn't see enough of his matches to think they really dropped the ball on him, because I don't know how good of a worker he truly was. But obscure reference. Cam, we got your number three. What do you have to say about Muhammad?
I think obscure reference. I tried to black out the WWE 2005, 2007-ish, kind of maybe a little bit 2008. Just try
the only
to
time I work there, thanks.
Hey, but you weren't creative or anything. It's like, I'm like, oh, screw the production team, dude. I hate this product because of the production team.
Damn it.
It's just one of those things where, I mean, yeah, I can see where you're coming from, Justin. Like, I'm real big on gimmicks, and when they screw them up, I mean, it's not necessarily the worker's fault. I mean, especially when they don't have any control of what they're doing once they go from out of Gorilla. So, yeah, it's one of those things where they just a swing and a miss. I mean, someone that's similar on my list, I guess, is Colt Cabana's WWE run. I thought when they brought him in, it was a good idea, and then they just completely screwed it all up, and they fired him for his fault, which is kind of funny. But, yeah, I just think the same thing, kind of just a swing and a miss on creative's part.
Yeah, it was – and like I said, I'm like, I might have put him on my list if I had gotten to see more of his work, but because, I mean, he was on for such a short period of time and then got stuck with probably the most controversial character in the 2000s, 2000 to 2010 is what I'm trying to say. But yeah, I think I would have wanted to see a little bit more of his work before I put him as being misused. It's kind of like the Rockus character that just popped on for one show and then disappeared. It's like you can't really judge too much about the guy because that was creative. Just going, hey, let's try this. Oh, no, this is not going to work. But going over my number three, this might be a little weird for some people, and it actually is more of a WCW reference now that I look at it. My number three was Brian Clark, who played Atom Bomb Wrath. He was part of the Chronic tag team with Brian Adams. For me, this was another guy who was a very big, athletic, professional wrestler that Vince McMahon always tries to drill into your head of this is what a wrestler is supposed to look like. I mean, he was agile. His moveset was always interesting. I remember him always coming up with different ways to throw somebody around the ring, and it was always like, oh, wow, okay, cool. I think that every single time he was in a promotion, I mean, he started out as Atom Bomb. It was like, all right, it's the cheesy WWF 90s where everybody had a weird-ass character. And then he moved over to WCW and stuck with a weird ass character until he was able to pair up with Brian Adams. But, I think he had the look, he had the size, he had the ability. but I don't think he stood out enough for people. He is the type of guy who needed somebody to talk for him. He needed a manager. Managers were not very big back then, and it was just a missed opportunity for him. He seemed to have everything right going for him, and just couldn't put two and two together. Justin?
Yeah, I agree. Adam Baum, I always just kind of get a chuckle every time I hear that name, just with the weird whole get up he had with the goggles coming out. It's one of those things I always look back out and laugh about. But, no, I can definitely see, I think his best time in wrestling was when he was with Bryan Adams and Chronic. But, yeah, I mean, I really don't remember too much about his career other than the whole Wrath, you know, Glacier feud, and that's pretty much about it. Like you said, though, I can see, you know, the big guy, he was, I remember him being somewhat agile for the big guy, but I don't really remember too much anything else about him.
Yeah, he was one of those guys I remember. He was one of the first big guys, and it was around the time when Undertaker was starting to do some of his bigger spots. But, like, I remember one of his finishers he used, it was a slingshot clothesline from outside. And seeing a guy that size being able to pull that off, I was impressed. And that was in the mid-90s for WWF. So it was around the time when, like, Bob Backlund was feuding with Bret Hart. So you had two guys who were very technical-based, and here comes this monster. And just creaming people off of the top rope or flying around and tossing people around. And like I said, it seemed like he had all the tools and it just never came to fruition. Cam?
I think, yeah, I mean, I kind of agree. I think you guys are trying to troll me on the WCW references. he's kind of one of those guys that, like you said, he could have just been anybody. I mean, anybody could have really played that character. He really didn't have, like, a standout factor. I'm, like, searching through my head as if it's YouTube, trying to, like, brainstorm old WCW matches he was in. But, yeah, just one of those guys that gets just, like, a swing and a miss kind of with creatives.
Yeah, I think it was more of, like, and it was the idea of creative has nothing for you. I think it was more of he had everything, but they didn't know what to do. It's not that they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what the best thing to do with him was. Like you said, Justin, the best time of his career was probably when he was a tag team with Bryan Adams, simply because they were a dominant tag team in the late days of WCW. And eventually, I mean, they moved over with the whole invasion angle and were the tag team champions and wrestled Kane and The Undertaker, I think, on a SummerSlam or one big pay-per-view. They had a title for a title match or something like that. But yeah, he's the type of guy, if you go back and you look at some of his work and look at some of the stuff that he was able to pull off, he always stood out among the crowd, but he never really had anything to sink his teeth into. And he definitely needed a manager. He wasn't the type of guy who could get away with just being himself and being able to put that over. He needed somebody else to speak for him, and that probably hindered him a lot as well. We got Cam's number two with Jake Roberts. Let me jump to my number two before we go to Justin. My number two, somebody who never technically he did, but he never wrestled for WWE, and that's Samoa Joe. I think for Joe, the way that he came into TNA and what he was coming off of at ROH was fantastic. I mean, this guy came in. He was what really put TNA on the map as far as in-ring work goes. His matches, obviously, with AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels are some of the best wrestling matches in the last 20 years. And this guy came in totally threw a wrench into everything that was supposed to be the X Division and turned up the violence factor, was able to talk, was able to be intimidating, but then was ridiculously agile for a guy his size, was bringing new moves and a new intensity into the ring that we hadn't seen in a long time. And then it just stopped. It just completely stopped. And now we have Samoa Joe now, and people are just looking at him like, oh, what was the big deal about this guy? Like, why were there DVDs put out on him? Why was he such a big signing when they brought him in? And that was Kurt Angle's first feud when he started with TNA. It's like, oh, what was the big deal about him? And people forget how great he was in Ring of Honor, and how great he was when he first debuted in TNA for the first couple of years. And he's just, I mean, he's almost turned into a complete joke now. And thankfully, in the last couple of months or so, they've tried to rejuvenate his career, but it took a hit, and it took a massive hit. And it's disappointing because it looked like he was on the right track to becoming a mega star for TNA, and it just stopped. It just completely stopped. Cam, I know you're covering TNA now. What do you think of that?
My number, or the first thing on my honorable mentions, which I almost put at number five, which as I think about it, and as you brought up Samoa Joe, should have been my number five, was the combination of Samoa Joe, Austin Aries, and AJ Styles. Before we started covering, I watched TNA, you know, here and there, because I like to be well-rounded when it comes to wrestling. I think TNA puts on great matches. Usually every week there's at least one or two solid matches. I mean, their stories are crap. Sorry, David Lagana, but just for the most part, like, stories are just not any good. But I think those three guys, even if they're in the WWE, because they probably would be misused just as badly, but those three guys alone could be the front runners of a company. Some company, I mean, you even go back to ROH, but some big company. I mean, TNA is missing out big time on those three guys. I mean, when your main event and your main guys are Sting, Hulk Hogan, Bully Ray, and Jeff Hardy, and your new signing of Rampage Jackson, who probably moves in the ring as good as I do. I think that they are just completely screwing it up. I think we judge the WWE when they try to push Cena and Ryback and the McMahons. I mean, at least it's entertaining. I mean, you try to sit through this main event stuff with Hogan and Bully Ray and Sting and all this crap. It's just crap after crap after week, and it's just like, these guys can't do it. You have 3 to 4, 5, even 6 stars that could carry this whole company, and all they are is they're always in the Bound for Glory series, or they're just somewhere just in the middle of the show every week, and it's just, it drives me completely insane.
Hey,
that's my teammate rant, sorry.
Expected at some point.
But like, I agree. I didn't used to follow TNA too much, but I'd always make sure whenever I knew Samoa Joe was wrestling, or like you said, he was wrestling AJ Styles or Kurt Angle, I always make sure to catch those matches, because you knew they were going to be good matches. Samoa Joe is a guy that is, he's a bigger guy, but like you said, he can work in the ring. He knows what he's doing in the ring. He's a guy, he's a veteran in the ring. He knows he's got experience. And then I think it might just be a case of where he's been in TNA for so long, and you would have think by now, like you said, he'd be a megastar. You could book this company around. But again, I think he's got that stigma of, well, yeah, he can work in the ring, but he doesn't look like a world champion. And that's something, obviously, I don't hold against him at all, but you know, I think it might be people that are in charge that say, you know, yeah, he's good, but he doesn't have the look of a top star or a guy you want to build your promotion around. And that's always something that holds back some of these guys in wrestling, but it's something I don't agree with at all. But I think, if anything, that might be why he hasn't gotten the big mega push that he got when he was with TNA.
See, what's funny, though, is like when he first started, he did get that mega push, and he was world champion, and he was at the top. And then it just stopped. Like I said, once Hogan and Bischoff signed on, that's when everything just stopped for him. And I think, in my mind, I'm glad that AJ Styles is getting a little bit back on track as character-wise. But for Samoa Joe, it was, he had everything. It was working. Everybody praised his matches, praised what he was doing. He was the monster killer heel, or even as a babyface, he was the badass that people were looking to. And it just stopped. And I mean, that's what kills me about it, because it was, everything looked to be going the right direction, and then everything just went to hell. It's a shame, because he's the type of guy who, especially now when you look at UFC and you look at things, like, people don't need to be 6'6", 230 with a six-pack. I'm like, they want – wrestling fans want realism in their wrestling. I mean, look at CM Punk, probably the most over person on the WWE roster. And he is does not look like a professional wrestler. And who cares? So the fact that Joe was dumped because of how he looks drives me crazy. But yeah, that's why he was on my number two. Justin, what was your number two? We never got to yours.
Yep, my number two is going a little bit way far back here in wrestling history. This group was only in the WWF for a very, very short time period, but I think had they stayed, they could have been huge, and that is the Fabulous Freebirds. I mean, obviously we know that they were huge and world-class with their feud with the Von Erichs. They're already well-established guys, and then they got to the WWF at the time in 1984, right around where the whole rock and wrestling thing was starting and the big crossover with MTV was happening. I think had they stayed with the WWF at the time, they could have been a huge, huge group. I think they would have had great success there. I think, like I said, Michael Hayes was a pretty good promo. He could have worked, I think, a pretty good feud with Hulk Hogan. And then for some reason, WWF wanted to split them up, which I have no idea why. I don't know what they would have thought the idea was behind breaking up a unit like that. I think they're one of the greatest factions in wrestling history, and I think at the time when the Freebirds were in the WWF in 1994, they could have been huge in that whole MTV crossover, and yet, they were there, and then they just kind of left. Like I said, it was a very, very short time span they were there, but I think the potential for them to be big players, especially maybe in that first WrestleMania, when it came around, would have been great for them. And it's just something that I would have liked to see, and it just kind of went by the wayside. It's like I said, we know them from world class, but I think they could have been even better in the WWF.
The reason why I didn't put – what was that?
Sorry, I was going to go in. Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
Go ahead. No, go for it.
I was just going to say, Justin, I think your number two is blasphemy. I understand where you're coming from, the WWE thing, but the Freebirds, I mean, just don't even consider their WWE run to even exist. The Freebirds are probably the greatest faction of all time. They're better than the Four Horsemen, in my opinion. But go ahead, Matt.
Yes, I was going to say something similar. The reason why the Freebirds didn't even cross my mind, when I was doing my research, I considered putting Kerry Von Erich on the list. Simply because he was in the WWF and he had the look. He was a good looking kid who came in rather young, came in, beat Mr. Perfect for the IC title, and it seemed like this guy could go far and could maybe be like how Shawn Michaels turned into a babyface worker, and or a Bret Hart or somebody of that nature, where it was a young, good-looking kid who is able to get to the top. And obviously, if you ever watched World Class, I mean, the guy was a rock star. He was the Beatles in Texas. I mean, this kid was money, and he helped keep World Class in business for many years. So to see him get onto the TV, win the IC title. It seemed like everything was going up from there, and I think it was the drug problems that finally got him fired from the WWF. But the reason why I didn't put him on the list was because of his run in World Class and in the NWA, and the fact that he was a mega star. He was around the time when there wasn't just the WWF and WCW. There was still the NWA and World Class and pretty much and Georgia Championship. There were those still those territories that he was a massive star in. So I couldn't put him as being misused, because he did achieve success in other places. It just wasn't with the WWE. And that's why I kind of had to shy away from him, because even though we didn't get to see him at his best in the biggest company in the world, he was still the best going. And like Cam said, the Fabulous Freebirds are the best three-person faction ever. There's nobody that even comes close. The Shield is far too young for anybody who's listening who live and die by WWF and WWE in the last 10 years. sorry, kids, there is no chance in hell that they will be around long enough to even rival the Fabulous Freebirds as far as being a three-person faction. They were it. They were the stable to be. And their matches with the Legion of Doom and countless other tag teams and countless other feuds, they were it. So, I mean, they sold out Chase Stadium. They sold out, I think they wrestled Yankee Stadium as well. They were selling out arenas. They were selling out football stadiums before WrestleMania ever even came around. So I really cannot even come close to putting the Freebirds on my misused list. But, hey, teach their own. Justin obviously
yep.
doesn't think he saw enough of the Freebirds. You better not be that guy at the concert who's always chanting for a band to play Freebird, or else I'm gonna punch you in the face. But I can't. Like I said, that was your choice, and that's fine. I'll let everybody on Inside Pulse and HTC rip you apart for that one, the way they did for your
finishers. I've seen them world class. I know they're a very good group. I'm not taking anything away from them at all. I'm just saying that I think in the WWF, I think if they would have stuck around there, that they could have had something very good going. That's all I'm saying.
I understand that. But when we decided on this list, we said in wrestling history. We didn't say WWF history. So you got to look at everything. I mean, we're talking WCW, NWA, ECW. We're talking everything. And right now, all of a sudden, you're backpedaling. What's going on here, Justin?
If we're going to do a poster on sorry.
Just to go into it. Justin? Any defense?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what Sam said. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, if we were going to do a podcast on WWE signees that they dropped the ball on, we would be here for a long time.
Well, yeah, that's entirely different. I mean, that's pretty much everybody. Any indie talent before NXT took over FCW, you can pretty much lump into that group. But, okay, so that was Justin's number two. We will post that later for people to comment on.
Yep.
What was it? Our top five underrated finishers? Was that the one that you got ripped apart on? Or
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Just making sure. I'm keeping tabs.
On the Bobby Lashley. Oh, then I remember.
Oh yeah, the Dominator. No, I saw it again when I was looking. I saw Rod Simmons on one of the rosters I was looking at, and I just shook my head. But anyway, Cam, let's go to your number one.
Before I want to get into number one, I just want to pay respects to Owen Hart, and I think before his tragic death. This is anything before his tragic death. I think Owen Hart was the greatest Hart that ever wrestled, I think, and we can talk about that if you guys want to. I think Bret Hart was maybe a better worker than Owen, but overall, Owen, I think, was the better overall professional wrestler. I think he was charismatic way beyond his years. I think if he was alive and grew up and was wrestling today, he would be more over than Owen or than CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, just because he was a special breed. And I thought once he won the Intercontinental title, I thought they were just going to really do something with him. And then, you know, they put him in tag teams with Jeff Jarrett, and then they were doing the Hart Foundation thing still. And I think that was just a time where they really, really could have made some money off Bret Hart. I mean, excuse me, off Owen Hart, maybe put the title on him and Bret, and because him and Bret had great matches. So, I mean, anything with the world title and them two, I mean, I think they really missed the ball on that one.
Before you say number one, is that your number one, or are you just throwing that one out there?
Yeah, that was my number one.
Oh, okay, that is your number one.
No, that
okay,
was my
good.
Number one, yeah.
Okay, I had him on my honorable mentions, and I'll tell you why. I actually had this discussion with my wife right before we came in here, because I was going back and forth on Owen and trying to talk myself either into putting him on or leaving him off. The reason why I left him off was mainly because the only time we ever saw Owen Hart in a main event, in any sort of main event feud, was with his brother. And I can't really judge how good of a heel he could have been, or a babyface he could have been at the top of the card, when he always had his brother either facing him or with him. I agree with you in that he was one of the most solid workers there was. He was able to – he kind of had the same personality throughout his career. It was either the whining, annoying Owen or the baby – generic babyface Owen. There was that. I don't know if he could have done more. And that was my problem and why I left him off the list was – yeah, they put him in tag teams. He won tag team gold countless times, and he won the Intercontinental Championship numerous times. But looking back on it now, I don't know if I could see him as being a strong enough heel to be in the main event unless he had the rivalry with Bret. I can't see him having a prolonged feud with Diesel, who is the champion at that time, or a long feud with Steve Austin as the champion, especially during the Attitude Era, I think would have been really weird. I don't know how well they would have played off each other. We didn't see too much of Owen being able to stand out on his own because he did die tragically way too early for us to really be able to see that. But also, if you go back and you read books on Owen, or if you read Bret's book, he said that when Owen did die in that accident, that he had said that he was only going to be wrestling for two or three more years because he wanted to retire, go home, and be with his family. So we might have never even seen an Owen Hart pass the point of when he died in Kansas City. It's hard to put him on the list. I completely understand why you did, Cam, because like I said, I had to talk myself almost out of putting him on the list. It was simply because we never really got to see what he could do without having Bret there with him. Justin, do you have anything to add to that?
I kind of agree with that statement. Like I said, I'm not taking anything away from his feud with Bret Hart from 1994. It was great. They put on two great matches at WrestleMania and at SummerSlam that year. It was a great, brother story that they had going there. But like you said, it would have been something where I think he would have been interesting to see outside of that, but he never got the opportunity to really do. He's always with somebody. He was in the Hart Foundation or in the Nation of Domination. And he never got the chance really to break out too much as a single star. He had his moments against Triple H and against DX where he showed potential where he could wrestle in the ring. There's nothing. You knew he could wrestle in the ring, and you knew that, if he was put in a match with anybody, he could get a good match out of them. But unfortunately, he never got the right push. I think he's, again, one of those generational guys where if you plugged him in today's WWE, he could almost have a similar role to something like a Dolph Ziggler, where a guy that could work and now would get the opportunity to get the main event push, unlike when he was around, where he was behind guys like Shawn Michaels and Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock, where he was overshadowed by those bigger stars. So I think if you saw Owen Hart wrestling today, he'd be a guy that I think you could see at the top of the card, like I said, like a Dolph Ziggler, where he could be a world heavyweight champion. But unfortunately, for his time period, he really didn't get the opportunity too much to go over.
Yeah, Cam, I want to let you follow up on that because we kind of brought up different things, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, I think especially his match with Stone Cold, when Stone Cold broke his neck, if Stone Cold didn't break his neck, you never know what could have been after that. I mean, Stone Cold became a top star, and I think they had good chemistry, especially in that match, and then they finished it. And I thought, just thinking about it, I think Owen was just, maybe I'm just building it up too much, but I thought he was really, really good on the mic, and I thought he could have been a single star. I mean, Jim Gamble, Neidhart, he was kind of just like a middle guy, British Bulldog, once again, another guy. I mean, Bret Hart became like the superstar and the legend that he is now, but I thought Owen really, really had a chance to be a star, and especially now, we talk about now, if you wrestle these days, especially how, everyone's being judged a little bit differently with Ambrose and Seth Rollins and Punk and, Daniel Bryan, all these guys that are smaller, but I think, especially in the time, maybe he was caught up in that, mid, early, late 90s where
bigger guys were over the shadow, but I think, you know, if he was given the chance, that he could have been a world champion.
Yeah, I think he probably would have benefited around the time of Kurt Angle, and you saw guys like Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit and those guys headlining SmackDown events, where in Eddie Guerrero. I could see him really thriving with any character during that time, because that's when SmackDown was really focusing on in-ring talent, and he had that to the nines. And as far as his promos go, his babyface promos, it didn't really do anything for me, and his heel character, the only one that really made a connection, a massive connection among fans and the audience and just WWE fans in general, was the whiny, annoying little brother. And we never got to see something past that. We got a little bit with Jeff Jarrett, but that was mostly Jeff talking and Deborah, and Owen would throw in the typical heel quotes here and there, but it wasn't anything that like would make my mind click and say, okay, this guy should be the WWF champion. Especially during the Attitude Era. It was a rough time for a guy his size and for the family legacy he had to live up to. For me, looking back on his career, the only time I would have put the title on him was, like when Justin said, was SummerSlam of 94. I think that was the only time I would probably consider him being world championship worthy. After that, it's kind of just in my mind that he was mid-card, and he was going to be mid-card for his career. He was going to be the workhorse that people look for and the veteran that people look to help out the younger guys. But I think he would go down. He'd probably go down in history as, if he had lasted longer, he'd probably go down in history as the same style that Mr. Perfect did, where it was one of the best wrestlers never to hold a world championship. I just, for now, I think it was because he was taken too soon. He just never really showed that main event potential that I think he could have had if given more time. But unfortunately, we weren't able to see that. Justin, let's move over. I'll do my number one last. So let's move over to your number one.
Okay, my number one kind of...
And dear God, somebody like Dean Ambrose or something like that, since you're going to follow it up with that.
It's almost in the similar mold to something like Owen Hart, but he was a guy from the 90s that was kind of held down in the Hulk Hogan era. And I think even when he moved over to WCW Nets, we talked about, he just brought up guys, the best guys that have never won the world title. I think Mr. Perfect would be almost right near, obviously Kurt Enning would be right near the top of my list. He's a guy who, I look back in the early 90s WWE, and I just think how he was a guy that couldn't have feuded with Hulk Hogan at all at some point. I mean, I know they had a couple matches, I believe, in the late 90s, but I think he's somebody that could have been a main event guy in the WWF at the time and had a good feud with Hulk Hogan and survived, especially because he had Bobby Heenan and was in the Heenan family, so you knew Heenan could put over a feud. You knew Mr. Perfect could work in the ring, and he just never got the chance to get past the Intercontinental title scene in the WWF. He was always, don't get me wrong, he was a good wrestler, having great matches with Bret Hart and with, like you said, Kerry Von Erich and those guys like that. But he never, I don't think, reached his full potential in the WWF when he was there. Like I said, he could have been somebody that feuded with Hulk Hogan, and I think even just for a brief feud at the time, maybe a SummerSlam where he could have done that. But they never put him up there. To this day, I still don't know why. And even when he moved to WCW, there could have been, he was still useful. There was still potential for him there. And then he just got lost in the shuffle with the whole NWO storyline. I think he's one of those guys, kind of like I just brought up the comparison with Owen Hart, where if he was a guy in his prime in the WWE today, he would be the Dolph Ziggler, winning the world title, being the chance to main event, pay-per-views, get put in big-time matches, and instead he was stuck in, like, as we call it, the Hulk Hogan era in the WWF, where it was the Hulk Hogan's, the Ultimate Warriors, and then nobody else. And I just look back and you think that he could have been a guy that, like I said, he could work a good match in the ring. There's no denying that. He just never got the chance to do that in the WWE, or I should say WWF at the time, as they called it.
Okay, so do I have to take you to school a little bit now?
Yes, go for it.
Kurt Hennig and Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig did feud with Hulk Hogan, but it was before the whole Heenan family thing. That's where the whole smashing of the Winged Eagle belt came in. The whole point, if you can go back, I think actually WWE.com put up the video when they introduced the new WWE Championship belt. But if you go back and look, the whole reason for him to destroy the belt, the World Championship that he stole from Hulk Hogan, it was actually a match between the Genius and Hogan. I think on Saturday night's main event, and Perfect distracted Hogan, so got Hogan counted out or something like that. So the Genius won. He beat Hulk Hogan, and then they took the belt, and during a post-match promo, Perfect took a hammer to the championship belt with Mean Gene Okerlund looking absolutely shocked and appalled by what he was doing. And they moved on to a really brief feud. But it was before the Bobby Heenan, before he moved over with Bobby Heenan, and it was before the IC title. He was relatively new in the WWF, and it never headlined a major pay-per-view. It was like in between WrestleMania and SummerSlam. So it wasn't something that really registered on the radar back then, but it was how he kind of made a name for himself as far as being able to stand out in the WWF locker room as a heel. He actually did get a shot at being in the main event. It was just too soon. If they had held off a little bit until he was already paired with Bobby Heenan, I think it would have went over a hell of a lot better. He would have been a little bit older. He would have had a better manager. People would have recognized him a little bit more, and he could have had a run with Hogan. And like you said, if he was around today, I mean, look at his son. His son, I still think his son is fantastic, and nobody's really getting to see that, and that's partly the fault of people having his father just literally etched in their minds and can't get that out of their head. And no, Joe Hennig is not as good as Kurt Hennig. The son cannot emulate the father and be better. Randy Orton is better than his father, but that was because he did his own thing. The Rock was better than his father, but because he did his own thing. Joe is taking a little bit too much from his dad right now that I think he needs to put his own spin on things, and maybe he'll stand out a little bit more. I couldn't put Mr. Perfect or Kurt Hennig on mine because I think he was booked perfectly, no pun intended, booked perfectly for the time frame where he wrestled. He was the benchmark. He was the guy that held the IC title, that had feuds with Bret Hart, and had feuds with Roddy Piper and Texas Tornado, and all those guys who considered the Intercontinental Championship as the workhorse belt. This was the belt for the wrestler of the organization. That's who we like to see. That's who we like to talk about. Those are our favorites. But back then, the WWF was all about being big, being bad, being a superhero in the ring, and that was Hulk Hogan, that was the Ultimate Warrior, that was Andre the Giant. Those were the guys. Perfect, I think, was placed where in position to where he was going to shine the most, and I think we all have such great fond memories of Mr. Perfect because of how well he was able to pull off what he was given. Yes, I would have liked to see him win a world championship. He had the in-ring talent. He could speak. He could do everything that was asked from him. I could definitely see him as a world champion, just not during that era. Cam, anything to add on to that?
Yes. I think people tend to forget that the IC title used to be what is basically what the world heavyweight title is nowadays. It's a secondary title. It pretty much means you're the number two, number three guy in the company. And like you said, it was the workhorse title. I thought, like you said, he was put perfectly, I guess, in that spot. I mean, he wasn't given the chance like Shawn Michaels maybe wasn't or was and Bret Hart was. But I thought he was, you know, right there as could always be the number three guy, a guy that could, you know, headline the house shows or co-headline the house shows, and people would come in to see him work great matches. And I think I agree with you about the Curtis Axel thing. I think they're just trying to get him over, and they're using too much of Mr. Perfect's gimmick, and he kind of is in a stuck point right now where he needs to find his own before this whole angle just fizzles out, and he's going to be right back to superstars.
Yeah, and as you brought up before, or you just said, the IC title was the number two. And back then, I don't know how familiar our listeners or you guys are about the house show schedule was like back during his time frame, but the WWF ran three different tour groups for their house show loops. You would have the A show, which would be headlined by whoever the WWF champion was at the time. You would have the B show that was headlined by whoever was the IC champion at the time. And you'd have the C show, which was headlined by whoever the tag team champions were at the time. So during Mr. Perfect's time frame, you would have somebody like, you'd have on the A show, you would have Hogan feuding with Savage. And then the B show, you would have Henning versus Hart or Henning versus Piper as the B show headliner. And then the C show, you'd be seeing like Legion of Doom versus Demolition or the Hart Foundation was still around back then. So it was like Hart Foundation, Nasty Boys or something like that. So he really was given the ball in the fact that he was headlining shows. They just weren't the televised shows and they weren't the pay-per-views. I think the management really did respect him and respected what he could bring to the table. He was just in the era of the big men, and it was crappy for him, and it's crappy that we never really got to see him as the leader of the WWF. But yeah, I still think that he did the best that he was given and was the best. I consider him the best Intercontinental Champion of all time, and I can't really consider him misused when I have that in my mind. But yeah, I understand, Justin, where you're coming from. It's simply in the fact that he should have been a world champion, and that makes perfect sense. Let me jump to my number one, because we have only about 5 minutes left. But my number one, actually still wrestling today, another TNA guy, Matt Morgan. Drives me absolutely nuts. One of the first articles I ever wrote for our website, which you can probably still find in the archives if you search Matt Morgan, was how to book Matt Morgan. Legit, just how he should be booked. And for me, he should be booked as The Undertaker was when he first started. Here is a guy who, I mean, he was a kid when he first started, and a young kid, but I mean, is this kid and this guy is close to 7 foot tall, can jump off the top rope, can fly across the ring, has every physical attribute you could ask for. Add that to the fact that he can talk. He's passable as far as talking goes. Throw him with the manager, I mean, or even if you do or you don't, no matter what, he has every physical attribute to succeed in the world of wrestling. And for whatever reason, he's never gotten that big shot. Like, they've always teased it, and they've always, like, kind of alluded to the fact that this is, he's the next guy to really, like, shoot forward, and he's the next guy, like, Hulk Hogan kept trying to push him recently, and it's like, it's always been, like, okay, he's next. Or, okay, like, yeah, it's going to be Matt Morgan's times now. Or, okay, he's waiting in the wings. He's going to be the next one to get a title shot. And then it just vanishes. And for the life of me, I don't understand why. He seems like a genuinely nice guy. It doesn't seem like he plays politics backstage. He works his ass off. And I just think he could be booked as a dominant force. And it's just never happened. Kale, let's throw it to you first.
Yeah, I guess Matt Morgan does fit in that kind of that same group. I didn't leave him on my TNA honorable mentions because I was leaning more towards the guys who are like go-workers. But, yeah, he's another one of those guys that, like I said, the WWE kind of just didn't know what to do with him. TNA, I just don't understand TNA when they're getting these prospects, you know, and they're signing these guys, and it's like, all right, you have guys that could basically be in the WWE in and around the main event picture, and they don't focus on it. And, like, he, I mean, not even really even think about making this list because that's how often he's used. I mean, he's used in tag team matches and six-man matches and, you know, just throwaway type matches on TNA and throwaway feuds that are never going to amount to anything. And, yeah, I mean, kind of high, I guess, for number one. But, but yeah, he's a good guy. I mean, I think he could be probably the world champion for TNA, but you never know. Hogan's supposed to be the next world champion for TNA.
Yeah, for me, and like you said quickly, said it, he could be world champion. I think that's what is driving me nuts is I think the only title he's ever held in has been the tag team championship in TNA. And like I said, this is a guy who has everything that, and if he was around the time that The Undertaker debuted, when there were gimmicks like that, he would be a monster that the WWE would put against The Undertaker. But they just never, like, I don't know if he just blends into the background and he just slips from people's minds or whatever it is, but for some reason, it's never come to fruition. You said he's kind of high for his number one, and I do agree. I went back and forth putting him number one or Samoa Joe. The reason why I put Matt Morgan was because he never was world champion. And, I mean, he's still got time. He's still got plenty of time. He's only in, I believe, he's still only in his early 30s. He's got plenty of time to do it. And I was a little disappointed when he re-signed with TNA because WWE is lacking big guys right now. And he would stand out among the crowd. And when TNA right now is big guys, it's Bully Ray as your world champion. It's, and Sting's was never really considered a big guy, but he is compared to some of the other guys on the TNA roster. And then you look at the WWE and it's John Cena, CM Punk, and randomly Brock Lesnar and something like that. But besides that, there's not like the comedy acts of Sweet Tea and Brodus Clay, but there's no real like big super heavyweights. And the way that this kid moves around the ring and the way that he's able to – he was always able to draw you into his matches. And now it's just, okay, he's just there. And it's frustrating because you see a guy that big have the look, have the ability, have pretty much all the tools and not even be given a shot. That's what's frustrating. Like, at least the other guys are given a shot to succeed. He just kind of gets to that cusp, and then people just completely forget about him. Justin?
Yeah, I agree. I remember when there was a lot of hype around him in TNA, I had made a point to go out and look at some of his matches, and I thought, like you said, he moves very well for a big man. He has a great look, and I just don't get, like you said, why he wouldn't be pushed. I remember at the time there was talk of him going to the WWE. I actually kind of wish he did go there, because like I said, I don't know how much better he would have been used in the company, but compared to how he's been using TNA since he resigned, I think he would have been used a little bit better than that. I think he would have been good in almost like a Batista-type role, where he would have been a guy you could be on a world title scene for a little bit. He's a guy, like I said, this man has a look that he likes, so definitely I can see how he's a misused guy, and like I said, it's the way they see how he's being used in TNA.
Yeah, it's what always really, really bugged me. It's like, I mean, they always go back, you think about his run in WWE. They gave him a stuttering gimmick. And it's like, that was just a death nail for him. So I understand why he left WWE and tried to make his own path in TNA. But I don't know why TNA hasn't capitalized on him. And, I mean, there's a lot of Matt Morgan haters out there, especially among the internet wrestling community. People don't get what I see in him or whenever I make a comment about him or just is so jaded by the fact that it's like, oh, he's got no personality or he has nothing to him, which I think is complete crap. I think he, if given the opportunity, he could be a top star. but the reason why he was my number one was that he had all the physical tools, he had the charisma, he had the ability, and it was just wasted. And he still hasn't gotten a shot at it, and that's hard to swallow. It's like you got this guy who seems to have everything. He's still young, he could still go, and yet you still keep him on the sidelines in favor of somebody like Sting and Hulk Hogan. And I mean, even Kurt Angle and Rampage Jackson. I put in the younger talent, put in this guy. I mean, even if they threw him in there and just had him go through like a Goldberg type run and had him just plow through the undercard and finally work his way up to the main event again, and that would be fine. Like, that's what you want to see out of it. You want to develop a monster, and he could be that monster, and they just won't do it. But yeah, that's why he was my number one. But that's all. And people are going to trash me on that one because they trashed me when I wrote the article about him too. But if you want to read how I wrote it, it was, like I said, it was one of the first articles I ever wrote for the website. It was a column that I was doing called Book This. And I think I did Matt Morgan, and I think I might have did Ted DiBiase at one point too. Ted DiBiase Jr., that is. But yeah, go back and look at it, and just the way that do a quick search on the right hand side. There's a little search bar if you wanna look that up on our website. But let's go quickly into that. We're running way over our time limit considering I wanted to do 90 minutes. But since we're already way over, let's quickly run through our honorable mentions. I'll just run through mine because I only have four. I had Owen Hart, obviously. We already talked a lot about him. The other three are weird. I had Paul Burchill. I thought he had a lot of potential for in-ring work. Just needed a good manager and somebody to talk for him and be put in the right situation. And even if it was the tag team with William Regal, and I think he could have lasted a lot longer than he actually did. Another one was Sean O'Hare. I think he had everything. He had the look. I mean, he stood out. It was just, I think he was too weird for the WWE. Just thinking back now into the Mr. America time frame and him being teamed up with Roddy Piper, I think he just kind of freaked some of creative out or some of the management out, and people didn't really want to work with him. And the last one I had was Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman, I think, was just far, far too ahead of his time. If he came in nowadays with somebody like CM Punk and Daniel Bryan on the roster, I think we would all be drooling to see those matchups take place. I mean, you knew he was a great worker from his time in WCW. Obviously, after his car accident, he didn't move as well as he did when he was Flying Bryan, but he still had it, and especially the whole loose cannon gimmick, and you never really truly knew what to expect from him. I think that he was a little misused, being thrown into a feud with Goldust, and then just that was about it until his untimely death. But I think they should have paired him up with Steve Austin the way that they were teaming, or not teaming, but the way that they were facing off with one of Pillman and one of Austin's first interviews when they both moved over to the WWE. I think if you had a feud between the two of them, considering they were such close friends, I think we would have saw a lot more of Brian Pillman than we got to see in his short life. Justin, any honorable mentions?
I had Sean O'Hare on my list as well. I also had the British Bulldog. I always thought the British Bulldog was a guy that could have been another guy that could have been a world champion. I mean, I think he was very well rounded in the ring, definitely a good worker. I also had where's my list? Who else left? I'm drawing a blank. I had it right in front of me. Vader's WWF run on my list. It was one of those ones where I think Vader could have been as big as a Shawn Michaels fan as I am. I think Vader should have won the WWF title at SummerSlam 96 and then built up to the rematch. somewhere down the line, whether it was in the Royal Rumble where Vader could have lost there to Shawn Michaels. That
yeah,
is
they
kind of
gave
it
his spot.
As my element is going.
I
don't know why to this day they did that.
Yeah, I understand because I thought they were gonna. I thought they would go with a Vader win at that SummerSlam as well. I mean, it really established Shawn Michaels as the world champion after that. Granted, he forfeited the belt not too long later. But I can understand why they gave Shawn that win because that was all during the time frame of we need to build him up as being the most well-rounded wrestler that we have and why he's the champion. But, Vader was will go down in history as one of the most athletic big guys ever to set foot in the ring. He was used great in WCW, and a lot of that I think came with the fact that Harley Race was his manager, and he was able to work with Sting, who is the epitome of a babyface. He was the ball was a little bit dropped on him. Cam, your honorable mentions?
I'm just gonna go through mine. I have like five or six. Marty Jannetty, and then I have the TNA combo Samoa Joe, Austin Aries, AJ Styles. Hacksaw Jim Duggan. I think anytime you're selling a bunch of foam fingers, or excuse me, foam 2x4s, that you got to push the guy up a little bit and let him carry at least one title in his freaking career. Justin Gabriel, I think he's in that same department with Tyson Kidd, that he can really move in the ring a lot better than most of the mid-card guys they have, and they still just don't ever use him. Mike Awesome, we talked about him earlier, and then I have Cole Cabana's WWE run.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Cole Cabana, because now the story breaking today is that he had a tryout to be an announcer, and then right after you read that, you find out that Matt Stryker's contract hasn't been renewed. So makes you question it. Honestly, if you ever listen to Cole Cabana's podcast, it doesn't seem like he has any wish to return to the WWE just because he's doing everything on his own now, and it's awesome, and he doesn't have to worry about a damn thing. So I don't know, it'd be interesting to see if Colt does come back as a color commentator compared to being a wrestler. I think he might like wrestling a little too much compared to Matt Stryker, was happy to move over to a commentating table. But those are our lists. I don't think there is too many controversial additions, except for the Freebirds. But I think we had a pretty solid top five for this one. Justin, I'm never letting you choose the topic again, just because of how much pain in the ass this was. But besides that, I think we had a nice, well-rounded 15 that we didn't really double up too much on, and that's always nice to see. Not for the guys that we talked about, because obviously they're not where they should be. But I think we did it justice, and hopefully some of the guys that are still around today and some of the guys that we're looking at will get another shot, and we'll be able to see them on a grander stage, or at least have a bigger role in whichever company they wish to continue with. That being said, we are going to wrap up here this week. We do not have a show next week. Next week is our week off. After that, we will be doing a regular show, and then another top five after that. So next week there will not be a Wrestling Pulsecast. The following week we are doing reviews. I don't think there's I don't know, Money Bigs on in between there. But then the following week we'll be doing a top five. If you are listening to this show and want to recommend a top five for us to do, please, please, please either comment on this post when I do post it, either comment on the post on the website, send us an email at htcwrestling@gmail.com, I completely forgot the other way to contact us. You can contact us through Twitter, comment on this, send us emails, do whatever the hell you want to do. Just send us your thoughts. We want to hear from you guys. We want to know what you want to talk about, or what you want to hear us talk about. You want to hear maybe a guest that we might be bringing on here and there. I have a couple people lined up that I'm kind of just kind of keep it a secret, but yeah, you might hear them on one of our top fives, WWE Creative. But yeah, we might have some of those people on again. It was fun having Andrew Goldstein on for our last one. So it'll be interesting. Look for in July, I will be conducting an interview with Jill Thompson. We kind of missed our connection the last time we were supposed to do an interview. Apparently she was working, and then I sat here waiting for her to call in, and completely forgot that we had an interview scheduled. So she was nice about it, though. We mended fences, even though there weren't any fences to break down. But hopefully we will be getting her on the show on Tuesday, or not Tuesday, in July. And we'll be able to talk to her and get her up onto the website, and it should be another great interview. But until that time, we are the HTC Hitting the Canvas Wrestling Pulse Cast. I am Matt Herrick with Justin Sirwanka and Cameron Daughtry. Again, you can find us at htcwrestling.com, insidepulse.com, or find us all on Twitter. All of our Twitter handles are on htcwrestling.com. There's a nice little box on the right-hand side where you can follow us. So get back to us. Tell us what you think of the show. Tell us what you want to hear about, and we look forward to hearing from you. So not until next week, but until the following week. This has been the Wrestling Pulse Cast, and we will talk to you soon.